This is the Drive and Dish Podcast, talking about NBA news, stats, and fantasy. To start it off, it's Tim Tompkins.
The San Antonio Spurs are the real-life equivalent of a sexy librarian.
Kevin Rayfuse.
The Cavaliers are like the kid that keeps dropping their ice cream, so you stop feeling bad after the first time.
And Justin Cousart.
A little life lesson here. If you're having questions in life, just think, would Swaggy P do it?
Let's go.
Welcome to the Drive and Dish NBA podcast. No Kevin, no Justin today. They are off doing amazing and fantastic things, I am sure. So what we're doing on this episode right here is we are going to be taking a look at what's next for the Indiana Pacers. This is a series we're going to roll out on the Drive and Dish podcast. When a team gets eliminated, we're going to take a look at how the series went, how the season went, kind of a recap. And so coming up for the first installment of what comes next is Grant Afseth on the show. He writes for IndianaSportsCoverage.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Grant Afseth.
Tell me something I do not know. Do not know.
Now.
If you do not know the present, how can you claim to know the future?
Now on NBA News on the Drive and Dish podcast.
We need to know now.
All right, first up in news, Russell Westbrook telling ESPN that Oklahoma City is a place where he wants to be. The Thunder looking to sign Westbrook to a 5-year max deal. Wizards forward Jason Smith suffering a calf injury during the Wizards Game 5 win over the Hawks. He's considered a game-time decision for Game 6. Warriors head coach Steve Kerr is seeing specialists at Stanford as he continues to deal with complications from his back surgery. He is optimistic about a return to the bench. Knicks center Joakim Noah had surgery to repair his torn rotator cuff in his shoulder on Wednesday. Recovery time for that injury expected to be around 5 months. And before we get into our Pacers episode, Pacers coach Nate McMillan says he's open to the idea of Lance Stephenson starting at shooting guard next season.
Something.
So Grant, going into the season, how did you feel going into it, and how do you feel now that it's over?
Going into it, I felt highly optimistic because they made a lot of moves. Their starting lineup looked pretty good with the additions of Jeff Teague and Thaddeus Young, but they had a few poison pills on their roster, like Monte Ellis at shooting guard in their starting unit and the 28th ranked bench in net rating. And some of the main components of that bench that were supposed to be major strengths, like Al Jefferson and Aaron Brooks, that people applauded them for signing, ended up being major liabilities. So when the season ended, it was a different feeling because, you know, it's kind of like the tales of four teams, really. The first quarter was, you know, a disappointment. Then the second quarter of the season gave you more reason for optimism. And then the third quarter was awful, and they failed to make any moves at the deadline. And then the fourth quarter of the season was highly optimistic with adding Lance Stephenson, and they won every game against non-Cavaliers opponents to close out the year and looked very good. So I guess now where we're at on the roller coaster ride is pretty optimistic.
So the Lance Stephenson signing was, I found it a little bit strange, but it really seemed to work. And, you know, to your point, Grant, they went 5-1 to close out the season with them. I believe that Lance Stephenson had the best box plus minus throughout the Cavs series. Why did that work so well, considering how Lance Stephenson has not seemed to work anywhere else?
I think he has an odd skill set that doesn't fit in many places, and Indiana has an odd supporting cast that has a weird set of needs. Like Miles Turner is still clearly developing as a rebounder, and Thaddeus Young is undersized and isn't a primary rebounder for any unit. So Lance Stephenson's great ability to be a defensive rebounder really helped because they limited the amount of second chance points they were allowing, which is a huge problem. And they had an added defensive bonus with versatility against cross match assignments that they didn't have with Monte Ellis starting. And they had another facilitator, and he was actually hitting threes at a high level and was converting on mid-range jumpers and getting to the lane, which is basically a lot of unexpected executing factors there. Like, it's just strange because Indiana, for the most part, before they got Stevenson, they didn't really have any advantages on a nightly basis to hold their hat on. They were bad at rebounding and had a negative differential in second chance points. They were supposed to be an elite turnover forcing team, but they didn't convert frequently on those turnovers. So they had just a slight advantage on points off turnovers. And they had a low volume of three-point makes, so they couldn't make up for that poor rebounding or inability to score off turnovers. And I think Stevenson's odd skill set ended up giving them advantages in those miscellaneous categories that decide games.
So to start off this season, when we were doing our season predictions and everything, we had on a Pacers writer, and he was all pumped up about the Pacers, and a lot of that has to do with what you were talking about with the defense, how they were supposed to create turnovers off of Monte Ellis with his hands, Paul George being a high steal guy, Jeff Teague really good at driving the lane, and they really thought that they were going to be able to succeed on offense on transition buckets. But that pairing of Monte Ellis and Jeff Teague in the backcourt, absolute disaster. It doesn't seem like you can pair those two together, and it was sort of like putting together a fantasy basketball roster. Monte Ellis, he's on contract for the next couple of seasons, a player option, I believe, for 2018-2019 and $11.5 million. What's the Pacers' next move with that?
You know, what's interesting is Zach Lowe figured out randomly, like 2 months before this, or no, 2 weeks before the season ended, that actually Indiana had a weird contract structure for their player options, that if they're waived prior to the end of the regular season when that contract expires, they don't owe them anything for that upcoming player option, which is what happened with waiving Rodney Stuckey. Was he was owed $7.5 million for his player option for this this next season, but since they waived him, they're not responsible for anything. So I think Monte Ellis could become a relatively favorable trade chip to a bad team who's looking to meet the salary cap floor by adding as much inclusive cap total as they possibly can without adding long-term money, because then they can waive him at the towards the end of the upcoming regular season or earlier if they really wanted to.
That's wild. Are the Pacers the only – how did they get away with that? What other organizations put these clauses in the contracts?
It's really strange because I didn't know that. No one knew that until like 2 weeks before the season, because Zach Lowe ended up having this piece that came out about the Pacers, and it was like, these are the only contracts that we know of in the NBA. So it was all really random, kind of like a thing you'll definitely take.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially if you're the Pacers. So they did just get swept by the Cavs. That being said, the entirety of the series came down to 16 points. Was this a success for the team?
Ultimately, I think you can say it was a success because, I mean, they didn't have Glenn Robinson III really until the final game because he had a calf strain. So they were getting abused on cross matches with Monte Ellis, and he was a negative for most of the season. And, you know, they just didn't have enough to beat the defending champs. So I think when you look at how they performed without another 3-and-D wing player, and they survived the first three games with Monte Ellis playing relatively heavy minutes, with the exception of game three, I think he didn't play as much as he did in the first two. That's definitely a win in my eyes.
So I was reading an article on The Ringer prior to doing this interview, and I wish I had the stat in front of me, but I don't. But it was something to the effect of the Pacers were outscored by like 60 points in 16 minutes while Monte Ellis was on the court, and that's kind of why you saw his minutes going down as that series progressed.
Yeah, definitely. Like the thing is I don't really fault Monte directly for his poor fit, because you know what Monte Ellis is capable of and what he's going to do. So you have to put him in a position to succeed. And playing an off-guard position against a team that really likes to attack mismatches with screens, you can't really expect results. But then when you think about it, Nate McMillan didn't ultimately have much flexibility to really change it up with, you know, playing Glenn Robinson III more minutes because he was injured. So it's kind of just like a circumstantial failure, I would say.
Paul George's post-game comments, seemingly throwing the different players under the bus. We've had a lot of debate on the Drive and Dish about whether that or not that is showing leadership. In my eyes, I'm on the side that it is not. What was your takeaway from all of Paul George's post-game comments in the series?
Well, you know, I think I can definitely see both sides of if it's leadership or not, because if you want a vocal leader who demands the best out of his teammates, then you would want him to say, hey, Miles, box out better, you know, do a better job. But the thing is, I don't really think that it's leadership if you're saying it in a post-game setting and not in-house directly to the guy's face. So I think it was he hasn't really been a leader in his career, and I think he's really trying to learn how to do that. So I don't know if it's more so, you know, disgruntled, you know, throwing under the bus on purpose, you know, to make excuses or all that. But I think it's more so he's just genuinely not a good leader, and he hasn't learned how to do it yet. But I would definitely have said that it would be better to keep that stuff in-house and say it to the guy's face and not to reporters.
I think Paul George made the right play when he passed out of that double screen. CJ Miles had an open look. It's about as good of a look as you can get to close out a game and possibly take the win as possible in the playoffs. Is Paul George clutch?
You know, he performed well in clutch situations this season, but previously he was not effective in clutch play, as you know by that stat ESPN was showing in the last 20 seconds of games. I believe he was like 0 for 16 or something like that on those go-ahead shots. So I think on big shots, he hasn't proven that in his career yet, but he really did improve his play in clutch situations before, like during the season, and he wasn't before. So I think he is clutch, but he hasn't been able really to show you on those big shots yet.
Paul George, the end of this last season, he really turned it on, seeming like he was going after that all-NBA nod. You look at him in a lot of seasons where he starts the season really hot and really strong and then kind of tails off. How can Paul George become a more consistent superstar?
You know, I think it starts with the conditioning factor, because when in 2013-14 season, he did fall, like, you know, after the All-Star break, off in his production. And then last season, after November hit, he really just – it was a boom, like a big cliff that he fell off of. Then he gradually improved each month after that. So the way I see it is with Team USA this summer, he said he was tired to start the game, and he didn't perform for the first 12 games, and he had an ankle injury, was out 7 games. And then after December 1st, he averaged an efficient 24.1 points per game. So I think what he needs to do is he needs to take Reggie Miller up on that workout offer that he gave him to go mountain biking in California and to get his conditioning, you know, at the next level, because it just seems like he just runs out of gas. Because I don't blame him, because he does move and cover a lot of ground on defense, and being a number one option on offense is a heavy burden when you're doing that on defense. So I really think he just needs really, really, really high level conditioning to be able to handle it.
In the bid for the 2021 All-Star Game, Larry Bird unveiled a new secondary logo for the Pacers. Really exciting stuff. What does it mean for the organization to get to host that All-Star Game? And what did you think of the new logo?
I think it's big for the city and the organization to host an All-Star Game, especially if they have the possibility of having 1 to 2 stars in that All-Star Game. I think that's pretty big, because obviously the economic impact is pretty substantial. I think it's like, I saw it's like $100 million revenue generating, you know, occurrence for like a few days. That's huge. But from the organization standpoint, I think it helps, because it boosts morale, and you can kind of showcase your two guys, assuming Paul George stays around, as, you know, to the league, and that's pretty important. And for the secondary logo, I think I like the colored version, because I saw on the Sports Logo Net, I believe it's called, they had like a colored version. I don't know if they're going to use that, because the trademark was the, you know, the black and white. But I don't know if I really like it, because it kind of looks like a Rhode Island mixed with Indiana. It doesn't have a lot of like fine edges on the bottom. It kind of just looks like a Lego block.
Yeah, I love that race car that he trotted out there, though. I thought that was really impressive. I don't know if it's something that maybe I don't pay close enough attention to, Grant, or if it just doesn't happen very often, but teams bidding for these all-star bids, are they normally doing it with this much press coverage and this many cameras and Adam Silver coming out and the race car and the new logo? Is that normal for a franchise?
You know, I haven't really noticed it that much in these past few years. But then again, I kind of feel like they have predetermined who gets those all-star bids. But I think it was kind of more of a big deal for them because they haven't put in bids. And I think they made it more of a spectacle than most teams do. So I don't think it's usual to have that much attention to it. So, yeah, I kind of think that was abnormal.
And you're listening to the Drive Edition NBA podcast with Grant Afseth from IndianaSportsCoverage.com. You can follow us on Twitter at DriveAndDishNBA. I want to talk about Nate McMillan. So, taking a look at this team right here, 15th in offensive rating, 16th in defensive rating. They aren't doing anything particularly well or particularly bad. Really great at making the three, but they don't put up a lot of attempts. What, 26th, 27th in the league? For pace, they're 18th in the league, so right there in the middle. What did you think about his performance, or I guess his coaching this season?
I think he made some poor rotational choices throughout the year because pretty early on, like I believe even in October, it was, to me, I knew Kevin Serafin should play over Al Jefferson because they need an athletic, dirty work specialist at their backup center position. And Al Jefferson, he's the opposite of that. And Aaron Brooks, he was a bad defensive liability his whole career, and he wasn't really providing anything on offense except taking touches away and time with the ball to key players. So he like stuck with some bad rotation choices and then used all bench lineups that really hurt the team. Like there were some games where they allowed like a 12-0 or 15-0 run, and then it was too much at halftime for the starters to cut back into if they made even a few errors. So I think he didn't make his rotation well this year. He stuck with some guys that really it was clear they shouldn't be playing. And that kind of held true in the playoffs too. But then again, you can't really fault him too much on that because Glenn Robinson III wasn't healthy. So you didn't really have much flexibility to work with there.
I didn't realize how much I liked Serafin until I saw him in the postseason. He's a big boy.
Yeah, I think he's like 270 or 280 pounds. He's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got some mobility about him too, which I really appreciate. Talking about Miles Turner, so he went from having the second best box plus minus on the team throughout the regular season to the third worst on the team in the playoffs. Talking about how effective or ineffective he was during the postseason, what was your takeaway from Miles Turner?
You know, what was weird is like, I believe March, I think, the team asked him to become more of a facilitator instead of shooting jump shots. And I really think that his thumb, I think he had a thumb or a finger injury, and he had to have it taped up or something like that. And I think that really hampered his catch and shoot ability, and that was a huge component of his skill set through the season because they don't use him much as a playmaker because he hasn't developed those low post skills quite yet. So I really think that he didn't have the confidence in those first three games, and he didn't quite have the role, really. He didn't shoot many catch and shoot jumpers until game three, and he was getting – it's just a bad matchup, really, because when you spend a lot of your minutes with Monte Ellis and LeBron James is able to play free safety in the paint, then you're not going to get a whole lot of clean looks. And you're going to have Tristan Thompson on your hip a lot of the times. And he's not a power guy, so he can't really fight through that type of shot contesting and impose his will like a Dwight Howard could or someone like that. So I think it was a mix with a bad matchup, and it was kind of a a bit of a circumstantial failure. And he also, like, when the small opportunity he had to play within his skill set, he didn't convert on it. And that's really tough to ask for a 21-year-old to have such a small margin for error.
Talking about his role in the offense, and I think it might have possibly led to his lack of a role in the postseason, the offense. You know, a lot of pick and roll, a lot of roll man, a lot of by the basket. What did you think of how Nate McMillan was using Miles Turner, his role in the offense? And if there's no Paul George in the future, which we're going to get to at some point during this interview, but if there's no Paul George in the future for the Pacers, is Miles Turner a player that the Pacers can truly build around?
I think he can, because he has shown a really high level of scoring without the ball, like without pounding it and making plays through like a traditional playmaking sense. Like he's a good cutter, he's a good roll man, he's a good catch and shoot player. The only thing he's missing is those playmaking touches. So I think he could average 20 to 25 points per game if you do give him that high level of playmaking touches. So I think he is a guy you can build around. But of course, in the modern NBA, you don't want to have your first best player as a center, because you'll get outscored with your lack of perimeter makes. So I definitely think he could be a second best player. But if without Paul George and a high-powered perimeter shooter, it's really hard to compete in the NBA building around that.
So you look at Miles Turner as kind of a 1B?
Yeah, I think so. Just naturally with how the NBA is, you just can't compete with like the Clevelands and the Golden States, who are averaging like 13 or 15 made threes.
Yeah, I mean, you're just trading, you know, it's a tale of the Oklahoma City Thunder, where you're just trading a 2 for 3 every single time. Looking at Miles Turner during the season, though, he led the team in defensive box plus minus at 2.6. The next closest was actually Thad Young at a 1.5. What does Miles Turner need to work on defensively to clean up that game, and can he get any better? Because I think he was, what, third or fourth in the league for blocks per game?
Yeah, he was. I think he averaged 2.1 blocks. I think what he needs to focus on, obviously, is adding weight, because he struggled against those bigger centers who can physically impose their will, like Dwight Howard. And it was just really tough for him. I could see some suggestions for boxing out too, because he doesn't get a body early on, guys. He he has like sort of like a stiff stance where he's standing up, and then he can't, you have to have superior strength to really grab those rebounds in those situations when you're doing that. So I think if he doesn't improve his box outs, it'll have to come from strength.
Moving into the offseason, Larry Bird said the teams need more shooters. So, you know, I was looking at the team statistics and everything. Fourth in the league by percentage, but as we spoke to earlier, 27th in attempts. Are there any possible free agents or trade targets that you see the Pacers going after this offseason?
You know, I was really looking into it today, and I guess it all depends on what Jeff Teague decides to do, because it's hard to really, you know, like if you think about it, they need more wing players that can shoot the three ball, and J.J. Redick appears to be, you know, one of the only like reasonable options in free agency, and he's old, like from the sense of trying to add to your core. So then you have to look to trade, like the trade market. And then if Jeff Teague isn't going to re-sign, then you have to think about, what am I going to do at point guard? Could Lance Stephenson possibly be an emergency option at point guard? Do I sign one? And then if you think about keeping Lance Stephenson at shooting guard, then it's really hard to know what your current status of your roster is to trade, like, for example, the 18th pick before free agency, if you really know what you're going to, you know, have heading into free agency. But I do think if they are looking to either play Stephenson at point guard or bring him off the bench, I think a guy like Gary Harris would be, you know, a good fit for them, because he is very effective in the whole pace and space aspect of the game, or really just any wing that can catch and shoot and play solid defense.
The Nuggets are really high on Gary Harris. Gary Harris, in my opinion, is one of the best up-and-coming shooting guards in the league. I love Gary Harris's game. what would the Pacers have to give up to get it, Gary Harris?
You know, I think a minimum, you'd have to center it around the 18th pick, of course, and then it would have to be more. I haven't really figured out what the Nuggets are looking for, because they're a tough team to really, you know, create hypothetical trades for, because they have a lot of just solid players at almost every position. I think the only real way you could is if you expanded the trade and maybe added another, I wouldn't say you want to add another first for a guy like Gary Harris, I guess, if you have the risk of Paul George leaving you, and then you have given up a really good draft pick for the following year. I think you could offer Thaddeus Young if you are looking to get a rebounding big man too, and get Kenneth Faried. And if you are getting two starters, you could be more willing to add an additional first-round pick, I would imagine, maybe with more protection, maybe a lottery protection or something like that. But it would solve quite a bit of issues having a boost in rebounding and three-point shot-making volume.
The Pacers are a tough team. Looking at their lack of assets, I think you guys have, what, like two players under the age of 25? You have a bunch of players leaving and, or, but you know, possibly leaving in free agency coming up. Talking about their cap situation, you mentioned Jeff Teague. He had an all right year, what was it, 15-4-8 on 44.5% shooting. Pacers, though, they already have about $69 million in cap space used up. You have CJ Miles. He's probably going to opt out of his contract. Do the Pacers keep him? They do have some guys that they owe, you know, minimal amounts of money, partially guaranteed contracts, between Rakeem, Glenn Robinson, Serafin. What do the Pacers do right here? Because yeah, Thad Young, he's owed $15 million next year.
You know, I think it all really starts with what you want at the point guard position, because they're going to try to build around Paul George, and I think that's the call you should make, because at the end of the day, the goal is to have superstars, and if you don't have them and you lose them, then you've already lost the ultimate game. So I think building around him and enticing him to stay is probably the right thing to do. And with the point guard position, what's interesting is Larry Bird, before the playoffs started, or actually I think it was a few days into the playoffs, he called Lance Stephenson their best passer and playmaker. So, and he's a better defensive player than Jeff Teague. So that kind of has me thinking what you could do to maximize your flexibility would be to let Jeff Teague walk and then maybe plan around Lance Stephenson at point guard, and then, you know, try to make a trade for a starting shooting guard, and then you do have a good starting lineup, and then you'd only have to worry about the backup power forward spot or the backup point guard spot if you do decide that Monte Ellis is no longer a contributor and you decide to do a salary-style dump trade, which I think they should do. But, yeah, I guess it really all depends on what you view the point guard position as, because Jeff Teague loves Indianapolis. He wants to I believe he wants to come back. But there will be bad teams that have a bunch of cap space to throw at a point guard, so they can't get into a bidding war. So if they can't, you know, sign him, then I think Lance Stephenson is their only on-roster option, which wouldn't be too bad. But I think you also have to look into trading for a point guard. But then I looked around, and there really isn't anything you can get for the 18th pick. So I think it would fall back to Lance Stephenson at point guard.
You saw Jeff Teague's Instagram post, yeah?
Yeah, I've heard that he likes, you know, obviously playing in Indianapolis, and I'm sure he'd want to come back. But then again, I guess it all comes down to how much does he favor playing in Indianapolis over, you know, a bunch of money?
Right.
Because 16 to 20 million is probably the limit, unless, you know, maybe 20 to 22 million, I would imagine, if you can generate more cap space. It comes down to how much Indiana values Jeff Teague, too. Because you can get creative and dump Monte Ellis and then pour a bunch of money into Jeff Teague. But then, is he really worth all that money? I don't think so. Especially if you've already called Lance Stephenson your best playmaker and passer.
So before we get into the listener mailbag section of the show, I want to finish this with one draft question for you. First, what do you think of Larry Bird's drafting record? And do you see him taking a position of need or a best player available style? Chad Ford says that the Pacers might take a shooter in Duke's Luke Kennard.
You know, I think he's good at drafting when he has a favorable pick. Like, he's churned up Paul George and Miles Turner, and then he's gotten some sleeper picks like Lance Stephenson. But what I'm thinking is it's really hard to think of a good draft strategy for this current roster because you need instant impact right away if you're trying to entice Paul George to stay. And I don't think anyone at 18 overall has the defensive versatility or the offensive skill set they need, because there's like Donovan Mitchell from Louisville, I believe, is another around option there. And then Terrence Ferguson. I don't think you can get that instant impact that you need for a starter and expect to, you know, make Paul George happy. And then if you think about their backup situation, Glenn Robinson III will deserve more minutes. He can play shooting guard and small forward, and there won't be many small forward minutes behind Paul George. So he'll probably, you know, get 20 plus minutes, and most of that will come from shooting guard, I would imagine. So there isn't really a, you know, a need to draft a shooting guard who can shoot if he can't start. So I would probably, that's why I was looking at trade scenarios to try to trade that 18th pick and maybe package whatever else is necessary for a legitimate starting quality shooting guard in his mid-20s.
Mailbag. You're listening to the Driving Dish Podcast. Tim Tompkins, Kevin Rayfuse, Justin Kuzart. Our guest today, Grant Afseth of Indiana Sports Coverage. Stuart O'Kell on Facebook asks, what would you require as a bare minimum for Paul George from the Lakers, Celtics, or Denver? And are there any other realistic teams?
I think the issue with trading a superstar is you end up running into the whole, you get a lot of role players. And then, you know, in the NBA, the whole goal is to have a superstar, right? So getting role players kind of artificially props up your win totals and then diminishes your chances of organically rebuilding by getting a superstar in the draft. So I think I would have to get a top pick, probably if the Lakers keep their pick, it would have to be that pick. And then if it was Boston, I would have to get one of those Brooklyn picks at a minimum, because you just can't build a team. Like, you'll turn into the Denver Nuggets if you trade Paul George to the Denver Nuggets and just end up churning up a bunch of solid rotational players, and you don't have an actual building block. I know Jokic can be considered a building block, and he should be, but really you need perimeter players as building blocks in this day and age. And if you trade a perimeter building block to a team like Denver for perimeter role players, you're just going to end up in the vicious cycle of mediocrity.
To me, there's so much that this Lakers pick and whether or not they get the top three is going to determine what happens around the NBA. Because if you're the Lakers, you can trade a couple of picks and maybe a D'Angelo Russell and maybe a Jordan Clarkson. If you know that you can draft a Lonzo Ball, or maybe you're willing to give up that pick knowing that you already have D'Angelo Russell on your roster. So you don't necessarily want to, so it's not a big deal because you don't want to have three young point guards anyway. There's so much relying on the Lakers, and it's really fascinating. Mark Jose on Facebook asks, how does the Pacers fan base feel about Paul George? Ready to let him go, keep him at all costs? Are they wanting to move on and rebuild around Turner?
I would say the vast majority is keep Paul George at all costs and play it out, because I think my followers have read my content and know that when they started a wing, like even an average wing player that wasn't an undersized guard, they had a very effective starting lineup and their bench sort of figured itself out. And that's why they didn't lose by very much against the Cleveland Cavaliers in the playoffs. So I think they act like they believe that you can do what it takes to get those solid pieces that they're missing, and then you could be a team that could make, like, you know, a run at an Eastern Conference Finals, and Paul George would be like, you know what, if I wait this out, Miles Turner will only get better, and maybe we could have enough as LeBron gets older. So I think the consensus is waited out because they have faith in the organization. And then there's there will always be, you know, like a small portion that says, you know, trade him because, you know, people read into those, you know, like Instagram posts and all that stuff very heavily. So they'll be like, he doesn't want to be here, so trade him now. Trade him while you can and build around Miles Turner. So I think, you know, 80-20 is what I would say in favor of riding this thing out.
Adam Cribbles, he asks, is there any chance that the Pacers can unload a Monte and or Stuckey and or Big Al without giving up too much for someone to take them?
Well, they did unload Rodney Stuckey, as we know, with cutting him. They somehow had that favorable contract structure and got out of that money. And Monte Ellis, I would say, that's a fairly realistic salary dump contract because, you know, bad team, as we talked about earlier, needs to meet this inclusive total to meet the salary cap floor. That's a favorable deal because you can cut them and you have ultimate long-term flexibility. But Al Jefferson is a different story. Not many teams need a back-to-the-basket defensive liability center. So, and $4 million, I believe, in his final year is all that's guaranteed. So, I mean, it wouldn't be impossible, but I think it'd be difficult if a team, you know, like I just don't see a team really needing his type of skill set. But then again, it's kind of amazing still in this day and age how many people, you know, value Al Jefferson's skill set when you listen to team broadcasts and all that. And you could also, an old school GM convinced them that PER alone is a good barometer for a player's impact, and Al Jefferson is like a 19.2, so maybe you can try to convince him that that's a good estimate.
Yeah, looking at the contract situation, so you have Al Jefferson signed through 2018-2019, to your point, with a $4 million guaranteed. Thad Young, you know, with that player option for the last year, but signed at $15 million. I don't know what they're doing with these contracts over here. Russell Guest asks, is Nate McMillan the right coach for this team? Can he keep them from falling apart and losing Paul George? That being said, in Nate McMillan's post-game conference, he was asked emphatically, is Paul George going to be here next year? And he answered with what I thought was a resounding assurance that he thinks Paul George is going to be back.
You know, I don't really, you know, I think Nate McMillan isn't that good of a head coach. Like, at least he showed during his first season with Indiana. But then again, I think if you have a management that puts together a team that doesn't have poison pill liabilities, I don't think he's going to lose you games. I think he can be an autopilot type of head coach. You know, like his philosophy won't lose you games, but he won't win you games. So if you have the team that kind of runs itself, you can kind of have an autopilot figure that kind of just, you know, is there.
I mean, the Pacers were the textbook definition of mediocrity this year. So I think that you might be right about that, Grant. Last question is Adam Bertles on Facebook. He asks, if and when Paul George is traded, a lot of Paul George questions in here, in case you haven't noticed. Do the Pacers go full rebuild, even if that means that Larry Bird steps down?
You know, I don't think they ever go full rebuild. I think they have the longest record for winning home record in the NBA right now with like 23 straight years, something ridiculous. They don't like to, you know, tank or rebuild. So I think they would probably trade him and then have 1 year where they're bad, and then they would probably do whatever they feel is necessary to be a winning team.
All right, and the last question that I have for you, Grant, I want to talk a little bit about the All-NBA selection. About 20% of the votes have been tallied out there on the internet because people are really good about it, and I appreciate it. From the first 20% of the votes, it doesn't suggest that Paul George is going to get the nod. Right now, he has, what, I think 12 is the way that they calculated it. He'd have to pass both Butler and Draymond in the remaining votes. How much does Paul George receiving an All-NBA selection impact, not his decision to stay, because at the end of the day, they've got to trade him, but his willingness to express to management that he will resign when his contract is up?
I think it's huge because, you know, $70 million is a lot of money to give up. And, you know, you can't really give it up if you're going to be someone who's willing to cash out for that much money. So then, you know, obviously him qualifying for the designated veterans exception, you can re-sign him this summer, and then it ends the whole, you know, situation. But if he doesn't make it, which I'm, you know, as you said, I don't think it's looking like that's going to happen. I would say he, you know, you probably will. They don't like to tank, and they don't like they would have a PR nightmare trading Paul George, and they have a struggle with attendance and, you know, fan base loyalty as it is. So I really think they would ride it out, and then if it's not looking good, trade him for whatever they can get at the trade deadline if their retooling process this summer fails.
Well, Grant, so people can follow you on Twitter at Grant Afseth?
Yes, correct. Yeah, Grant Afseth.
And so you work for IndianaSportsCoverage.com. I was over at the website. It's a little bit hard to read because you have to be a member in order to check out any of that stuff. But do you have any other writing anywhere else on the web that people can check out?
That's where all my stuff is right now. I do a little bit of editing on Miles Turner's website, but ultimately, yeah, it's basically on there. But yeah, I'll be running some specials for lower membership rates because I'm trying to save for college and all that stuff.
I got you. All right. Well, Mr. Grant, thank you so much for coming to the show. You can follow him on Twitter at Grant Afseth, and you can find all of his writing at IndianaSportsCoverage.com. Grant, thanks so much for your time, buddy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I think we've done enough dancing for today, so why don't we dance Wednesday?
See you, Starside.
Okay, well, I'm out of here. Pick it up! Da-da-da-da-da. Hey!
Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da. Hey! Let's go while we're young.
All right. I think they get the point.
With me, we are PHX. We are PHX. I want you to check out a brand new Phoenix Suns podcast called The Solar Panel, a Phoenix Suns podcast. Tim Tompkins, Greg Esposito, Dave King for a weekly Phoenix Suns podcast. You can find The Solar Panel, Phoenix Suns podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, and sunspodcast.com. We are PHX. We are PHX.